The views expressed on this show by guests and the hosts on issues outside of the 9/11 controlled demolition evidence are the opinions of those individuals alone and do not necessarily reflect those of architects and engineers for 9/11 truth.
Welcome to 9/11 Freefall. I'm the host, Andy Steele. Today, it is my honor to be joined by G. Edward Griffin. He is a writer, a documentary film producer, and founder of Freedom Force International. His books include The Creature from Jekyll Island, A Second Look at the Federal Reserve, and Fearful Master, A Second Look at the United Nations. He's been a staunch voice out there in defense of liberty and freedom for many decades. And I think that is a voice we need to hear now in these current times, especially in the 9/11 truth movement, because it's without freedom or liberty, we can't do what we do here in educating people about the biggest mass murder in U.S. history and, of course, the biggest cover-up as well. So, sir, welcome to 9/11 Freefall.
Well, thank you, Andy. It's my pleasure to be part of your well-informed group.
So we had you on a few years ago, and you told our audience your story of waking up to 9/11, but I know that you've been out there talking about various issues in our society and our march towards more tyrannical government for many years. So, you know, you were already on board right from the beginning, knowing exactly how government operates and what we can expect in the future. So I'm going to begin by asking you this question. Share our audience your perception on 9/11's effect on the concept of being American and where we've gone from there until today. Because it seems like the concept of being an American was much different before 9/11 and everything that followed, at least to me, but you may disagree.
Well, no, I don't disagree, but I do think that being American, it was a quality that wasn't shared equally by everybody. It depended to a large extent, I think, on the social circle or the business circle that we traveled in. I reluctantly had to accept the fact that I was living in kind of a little paradise. I didn't realize how far adrift from the traditional American concept the country had drifted, because all of my friends were, you know, they were pretty much like I was. We all lived in, you know, in the same state, in the same part of the state. We went to the same meetings. We read the same books and so forth. And we kind of reinforced each other, not realizing that out there in the big world, the real world, things were changing rapidly, and we weren't really aware of it. So I guess that's the only addition I would make to that, is that, and that process is still going on. But to me, being American, I'm embarrassed to admit it, back in the early days, before I knew what the heck was going on in the world, to me, being American didn't mean an awful lot, except that, God, I'm glad I'm an American, that's all. I'm one of the lucky ones, because we live in a nation of freedom and tolerance and brotherhood to the largest extent of any place in the world. Not perfect, but darn better than most places I'd ever been to and had read about. And I was just, okay, that's good. I'm glad we can check that off and get on about making a living and having a good time and raising my family and all that. So being an American was one of those things that I just took for granted as being a wonderful thing. And I, you know, I've always got that nice feeling when they played the national anthem and we pledged allegiance to the flag and all that stuff. I was a very patriotic guy. And I wasn't quite sure in those days what our tradition was. Well, I just knew it was our American tradition, and by golly, that was good. It wasn't until afterwards when I realized that all of the things that I really valued, my privacy, my property, my family, my freedom, my health even to a large extent, all of these things were under attack. And then I started to get serious and started to learn more about the real world, took my first pill on the topic of the United Nations. And that, of course, led to my first book, which was called, you know, on the United Nations, called The Fearful Master, a second look at the UN. And so that was a turning point in my life. I began to wake up and take an interest in what was going on around me. And then I discovered that, oh, my golly, my concept of being an American was very, very thin. It's very vulnerable. I didn't have any substance to it. And only then did I really begin to study, and I started to read books and attend lectures and all of that stuff. And I learned in my middle to late 20s, I really learned what America was all about. I really learned what the concepts were. I really learned for the first time why certain provisions were in the Constitution and why, especially, what so many of those words meant in the Declaration of Independence. It was only then I began to read the debates, leading up to the Continental Congress and during the Continental Congress, during the Constitution, when the framers of the Constitution were arguing back and forth about this, that, and the other thing, and discussing the fine points and what this would mean for the long term and the future. Only then did I really understand what being an American was all about. So I was lucky, still only in a different way. This time I was lucky because I was prompted by circumstances largely to take an interest in these things, and thank God I did, because I discovered there was a rich world there, a world I was missing, a world that really meant something, a world that turned me on fire. I mean, I really became a crusader rabbit. I never was a crusader before. I had been in the military, and I remember the first rule they half-jokingly taught you when you go in as a raw recruit. They say, all right, soldier, the first thing you got to remember is don't ever, ever, ever volunteer. And the second rule was, don't ever, ever be noticed. Stay in the background, And so I followed that rule to a large extent, and all of a sudden I discovered, no, I can't do that. I have to volunteer. This is important. Somebody's got to do this. So I didn't know I had that part of my character in me, but so I was lucky. I'm rambling a bit here. I'm sorry about that, Andy, but you said, what does being American mean and how did it change? Well, I don't think it changed necessarily on 9/11, but it certainly brought it into focus because it had been changing quite gradually ever since, ever since the founding of the country. In my studies afterwards, I realized that this great republic that they had created, the system of, it really wasn't even a government. I regret that they called it a government because it wasn't, the purpose was not to govern. I've always been a little bit perturbed by the fact that we use the word government to describe the state. So the kid is asked in school, what kind of a government do you want? Well, I don't want any governments. I don't want to be governed. Is that? No, I don't want a government. Well, what do you want from the state? Well, I want the state to protect me against things I can't defend against myself, like a foreign invasion or crime or fraud. I want protection, but I don't want to be governed. I'm the governor. I'm supposed to govern those people that I hire to do these things for me. And so I always thought that we should have called the system that was created, we should have called it a protectorate, not a government. So I was learning all of these things. And so that's my journey. And we come to 9/11. And of course, everybody got very patriotic at when 9/11 came because they thought we were under attack by a foreign or enemy outsider of some kind. People, that didn't look like us, didn't speak our language, came from a different part of the world. They were the bad guys, and we were under attack by these people. And so everybody went and bought their American flag for the first time. Of course, I had my American flag for a long time, but still, there was a run on American flags, and they were all made in China, which I thought was kind of funny. And everybody had an American flag on their antenna because we had been attacked. Well, that didn't change them any, except they were, they were responding emotionally to the fact, well, we got to rally around our leaders now. And therein lies the story about 9/11 and every other aspect of the crisis theater that we have been subjected to all these years. We have to rally around our leaders, around our government. We have to rally behind them because it's our patriotic duty to do so. We are under attack. And that is the thing, I think, the lesson that many people have missed is that we are under attack, not necessarily by somebody outside who wants to invade us and take over our country from the outside, but we are under attack by people who live inside our borders, who carry American citizenship on their passports, people who were raised in our schools, our schools, taught by Marxists, of course, but our schools, nevertheless, we paid for them. We're under attack by our own, within our own shores. And in order to do that and for us to rally around those who are attacking us, we have to be scared to death. We have to have a crisis on our hands. And whether it's 9/11 or COVID or terrorism or pornography or whatever it is, environmental decay, it's always we've got to rally around our government to protect us. And so therein, I think, is how this all ties together in my mind, is that we're living in an era of manufactured crises. And I mean that literally, manufactured. I think some people are going way out of their way, spending a lot of money and spending a lot of manpower to create a crisis. Not that we don't have problems. Of course we have problems. But I've read the textbooks of some of these people, and they say right out in the open that we've got to have something that is sufficiently dramatic and frightening that the people will stop asking a lot of questions about liberty and start worrying only about protection and safety and survival. Then we can change society. And that's exactly what we see going on today. And, of course, that really started in spades on 9/11.
That is correct. I remember growing up, and I've said this so many times on the show, I'm probably becoming very repetitive, but I do remember that things would happen in the news, and we would follow it, but there was never anything that would affect me personally. I wasn't taking off my belt at the airport and my shoes. I wasn't being locked inside my house and being forced to wear masks at the grocery store, you know, but it all started on 9/11, where they started with this we talk. You know, we have to make sacrifices. We have to be united. We. And before 9/11, it didn't really seem like that big of a concept of we. To me, America is about the individual. Individuals having their own opinions, provided that they don't trample on each other's rights. They're allowed to have those opinions. So we have changed, and I've asked myself, you know, what changed other than 9/11 shocking everyone into submission here? And I think it's the ability of the system to reach people. I mean, we didn't have 24-hour news networks back in the 80s, other than CNN maybe, but it was just getting its legs under it. By the time I graduated college, we had at least three I can think of off the top of my head. And then now with the internet and the computers and the phones, people are just so dialed into this stuff that they follow every single minute of it. And that sounds like it's good. It sounds like everybody is so informed. But the problem is, with them censoring everything now, people are just getting one piece of information. Really, it is just one, whether you're getting it from the right or from the left. You're just getting whatever the establishment narrative is, and then you pick the side that you want and cheer for that. So everybody got dialed in, and they're being propagandized more as the alternative voices are being pushed out. And that is no joke. It is happening. I mean, I don't even have to go over the news stories about censorship taking place against people who are speaking out about various issues going on today or even issues from the past. I want to get your thought on that, about the closing down of information that challenges mainstream narratives as we're seeing it more and more happen.
Well, absolutely, because I suppose you could say that almost anything that you're talking about which has power over people is the weapon of the enemy or the favorite weapon. But right at this moment, I would say that mastery or dominance of communications is probably the most powerful weapon to control a population, even more so than the threat of military type weapons, guns, bombs, gas, chemical warfare, all of that. Those are terribly important and frightening weapons, and people will obey their masters in order to escape being attacked by those kinds of weapons. But the superior weapon is where you capture the mind and convince people that they want to obey, that it's for their own good to obey. And therein lies your comment about the we part. Yeah, you've noticed, I suppose, especially in modern times, late times, when you hear somebody saying, well, we have to, all get our vaccines. We all have to wear masks. Or we have to do social distancing or whatever. Or we have to get through that line at the airport because, you know, there are terrorists out there and we don't want any more planes being flown into buildings, et cetera. All of that. When they say we, that means us, not them. The ones that are telling us that using the word we are not having to comply with any of that. Yeah, I don't know if people notice that or not, but they're on the exception list. So the we, in this case, is us. And the people using the word we really are, I don't know whether they know the game that they're playing or whether they're just going along to get along. But anyway, they're the privileged class. So back to your question, I'm deeply concerned over the lack of freedom anymore that we have lost our freedom to express our points of view. Well, what we're talking about right now, it's quite possible, if things continue the way they are, that within a year, this kind of conversation will be either forbidden or severely punished. And what we are seeing playing out right before our eyes is exactly what happened in the rise of Nazi Germany and fascist Italy and communist Russia and China. All of those collectivist countries, whether they be communist or Nazi or fascist, they're all different variants of collectivism. All of them went through the phase that we are now going through on their way to the gulags, the torture chambers, the execution chambers, the mass murders. All of them went through the phase we are now going through, and we're going through it more rapidly than they did. And once you understand that history and you know what happened in these other countries and you look at what's happening now, it makes your blood run cold. Because even now, most people don't see this. They think, oh, well, as soon as, next year, well, we'll get a new man in office and everything will be fine. No, everything is not going to be fine unless we do something more fundamental than just vote for some candidate chosen by some invisible chamber that we don't even know who they are, choose these candidates. Usually they're guys with the big pocketbooks, the bankers and the world financial leaders that can afford to literally buy off whole congresses. Unless we wake up to the fact that we're on a track that's heading straight to hell, we're going to get there. So I'm on my crusade again, only more fiercely and strongly than ever before, because I see it's coming so much closer.
You know, I see what I call, there may be a more academic term for it, but I call it cultural tyranny here in our society, where everybody is being made neurotic over what they say out of fear of offending people, where you can be canceled, you can be shut down. And I think this is what leads to the tyranny being cemented in law eventually. If you can get everybody scared of what they say or of having conversations like this, it becomes easier to cement it in law later on. That's why I believe we have to be unapologetic in what we say, stand by it, say it boldly, say it strongly, and not worry about the dirty looks or the naysayers who want to shut you up. This is something that I wanted to get your opinion on, because we celebrate freedom and openness in this country, and those are good things. That's what makes this country great. It's made this country great for several centuries. Unfortunately, though, freedom and openness in many ways has been exploited and used as a way to restrict freedom and openness. So the enemies of freedom and openness use schools, use organizations, media, and such to reinforce their message to shut down the people who are advocating freedom and openness to talk about things like 9/11, for instance, but other issues as well. And cancel culture is a perfect example. It's so known now that I don't even have to explain what cancel culture is. What do we do about that conundrum? You know, you don't want to just clamp down and restrict liberties on people that are criticizing our institutions and our traditions and our openness, because then you become that yourself. But how do you fight that?
Well, you fight that, I think, by having an informed electorate and having candidates who are really there to represent the people, and rather than represent the financial groups that pay the bills to get them in office. You know, the old saying is that these congressmen and senators, they get a lot of mail, but they don't read the ones that just give advice or complaints. They read the ones that contain the envelopes that contain checks. And that's the way it goes. That's the reality. I was very unhappy to face that reality some years ago, because I always thought that my congressman and my senator really cared about me. And they said they did, but I was stupid enough to believe them. But anyway, if we had a system where the people in office really were not there to feather their best or to serve some hidden master, whether it be financial, social, or maybe they're being blackmailed. God only knows what goes on in those circles today. But they're not serving the people. They're serving some other groups or individuals because they're masters over them because of money or social pressure or something like that. And that's the problem. It's not really very mysterious that we've built a system where we thought that the government should be, you know, the government, there's that word again, we thought that the state should have all unlimited power because that's what it needs in order to solve our problems. If we're going to get rid of pornography, we're going to get rid of crime, get rid of poverty and hunger and all that thing, well we got to have some very powerful government. And so we willingly, gladly, eagerly give away the right to unlimited funding, unlimited decision-making power to change the rules of society so we can fight all these bad things. And then we wake up in the morning and say, what happened to us? Well, we're in chains. That's what happened to us. So it's the system itself, because when you have that much power and money concentrated in one place, I don't care whether it's government or corporations or families or whatever, that concentration of wealth and power is like a magnet. And it attracts the predator class in society. All the crooks that seem on the surface to be very nice people, they're very congenial, they crack jokes, a lot of them go to church, and, you know, they're nice neighbors, and they're fun at the parties and all that. But deep down underneath, they're the predators. They want what you've got, and they don't want to work for it. They just want it. And so they figure out ways to convince you that it's a good idea for you to give it to them because it's in their self-interest. I come back to that theme again. So what we're living in is a fantasy world in where we think that our system is one thing, but in reality, it's a mechanism of plunder, legalized plunder. And that is the problem. And we've got to change it so that when people are elected or appointed or however they get into office, that's another question. Elections are not necessarily the only way. In fact, for many reasons, elections are very dangerous because they can be rigged. They can be influenced by media. People can be lied to and deceived, and they can vote the wrong way because of the information they get. And it's easy to control the thinking of the masses if you control the information they get. And that is one of the Achilles heels of the democratic system, where everybody gets to vote on everything and they don't know what the heck they're voting for. And so, anyway, back to the main question, I think if you had a system that was a true protectorate and the rules and regulations were written into the Constitution that the purpose of the state is limited to only three things, life, the protection of life, liberty, and property, and nothing more. If you had that hardwired into the Constitution, it wasn't there to educate people, wasn't there to protect them, to provide health care, housing, food, shelter, education, and none of that. It's there to protect their lives, their liberty, and their property, because that's the only thing you can use. You and I can use force, coercion, is to protect our lives, our liberty, and our property. We're entitled to do that. If we have to, we can kill in order to preserve our own lives and so forth. So that's the only reason that we can authorize the state to use force for, because we don't have the authority to do it ourselves. Therefore, we cannot delegate that authority, which we do not have. We cannot delegate that to the state. So once we get the state reorganized in principle, in the constitutional level, so that it cannot constitutionally do anything other than that defensive act, then I honestly believe that about 99% of all of the problems we're talking about would disappear.
That's right. And, of course, regarding 9/11 and the science of what really happened, I mean, to me, this is an open and shut case. Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth has made this case long ago. The only obstacle now are the roadblocks put up by media and by government. You know, I saw a great political cartoon, I think it was on Facebook somewhere, of one giant person leading another person by a leash, and that middle person is leading an even smaller person by a leash. And the giant person is labeled with politics, the middle person is labeled with science, and then the smaller person is the people. And so politics, and in many cases, is leading science now. So even though we were taught that 2 + 2 = 4, and that there's certain scientific principles that can't be argued with regardless of the agenda of the people arguing them. We're seeing that completely reverse on its head now. We've seen it with NIST for many years, and that needs to change. So to me, the solution is very simple, but it has to be exercised, though, by each and every individual listening to this podcast right now, is that you have to just speak the truth. And that sounds like some kind of rhetorical statement, but it's really powerful when you think about it. I mean, again, not succumbing to the dirty looks, not giving in and keeping your voice silent just because the mainstream narrative says otherwise. You say that there is no way that Building 7 could have fallen in 6.5 seconds without explosives. You state it, and you don't apologize for it. You don't sound like you're wishy-washy about it. And you stick to your guns, regardless of if anyone follows you or not. And only by people speaking the truth do we come to any kind of change in society. I mean, think about it. If you have a marriage and a woman has seen a picture of her husband having an affair, even if she never sees that picture again, even if she doesn't get to keep it, I mean, that image is going to be burned in her brain, and it will affect their relationship. Maybe she changes it, or maybe she doesn't, but it will affect how they interact with each other in the future. So even if you can't get it on television, show the evidence to people in your circle, and then they carry that forward, and that influences their decisions. And if enough people do that, the whole society will change. I want to get your thought before we close out our last 2 minutes here. You know, there's a struggle between truth and freedom versus control and tyranny, and I've learned just because one side maintains power doesn't mean that it's necessarily winning. Just seeing what a joke government and media has become, where do you think it stands right now? Are you hopeful? Are we winning in any sense?
That's a tough question. I guess it depends on how you define winning. If there are a lot of jokes about that one, by the way. Yeah, we're winning. That means that we're losing less rapidly, you know, that kind of thing. But it's a good question. I think we are losing the battle in terms of the actual control over the state, which has the ability to force us at the point of a gun to do what we're told to do. We've largely lost that. I mean, it was quite far gone a long time ago. We just didn't know it. Because the people that were running the show, we voted for them. We thought, well, we voted for them, so therefore they have to be good people. When in fact, they were no different than the ones before them and the ones before them and all of that. But so in that sense, we have almost completely lost control over the mechanisms of coercion. We've lost control over the mechanisms of information. We're losing control over the mechanisms of transportation pretty soon. We'll lose control over the mechanisms of agriculture, the food we get. That's practically on its way out. So we're losing on all those important levels. But where we're gaining, and this is the area of hope in my mind, is that the people are, because of this great tragedy that's happening, they're waking out of their stupor by the millions. And you don't see that until maybe there's a rally. We saw it a couple of times last year where they had these huge rallies in Europe, and they take the pictures of the crowd from the air. Turns out that there were a couple of million people there in a rally just to protest against having to distance and wear masks and so forth, because they were all convinced that the pandemic was an illusionary thing. It was manufactured. It wasn't even real. Nobody was really dying from a bug. A few people were dying from the flu bug, but those deaths were called COVID deaths. Anyway, all these people saw that, and that number still is increasing, and so forth. But that can't continue without something happening to reverse this trend back on the main stage, which is where all the forces of coercion are held. If the number of people suddenly wakes up to the fact that they're being scammed, or I guess the gamers call it pawned, when they finally wake up to that, it's going to be very difficult not to bring about the kind of reform we seek.
Absolutely, and the best way to get the conversation started is run a quick video of Building 7 and then go from there. And trust me, people wake up to a lot of things when they wake up to 9/11 truth, just like myself. Sir, it is an honor again to have you on the show, and maybe I'll have you on again in the future, but thank you so much for coming on 9/11 Freefall today.
Well, all right. I really appreciate it, Andy. Thank you very much, and good luck to you.
This program is on every Thursday night on No Lies Radio at 10 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Pacific, and every other Sunday night on BBS Radio at 8 o'clock Eastern, 5 o'clock Pacific. You can also keep track of the archives by going to 911freefall.com. This is Andy Steele. So have a great week. Good luck.